I was sort of toying with whether or not we were ready to move on to the next chapter, or whether was there some unfinished business that we hadn't yet completed with our discussion of Mila and Pesach in Parakeh. And I decided on the latter because really I owe you two things. Number one is a piece of the discussion that I had actually skipped and then realized that it created a gap in our conversation. So we're going to go back to that. And number two, because we hadn't, at the end of last class, I went and I kind of re-listened to last week's, I did not yet get to the nature of Bris Mila and how it ties into this whole context of entering into the land of Israel and relationship to the Korban Pesach and relationship to the Brit. So we have some work still to do. I'm going to therefore devote this shiur, at least the first bulk of it, to that kind of postscript or finishing up of that unit. And if we have a chance to start chapter 6, we will. If not, then we'll Bezrat Hashem start next week. So we are going to share screen. And I want to start with this list. This is a really interesting list. I once put together a brief list of every reference to the, not Pesach as a mitzvah, but the Korban Pesach as an experience, meaning every place in Tanakh where we are told that Bnei Israel fulfilled the mitzvah of Pesach, or they performed the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach. Obviously, they did it every year, but it doesn't play a role in the story of Tanakh every year, but it does at certain interesting, critical moments. The first three are essentially what we have been looking at over the last couple of class and a half, namely Pesach Mitzrayim, which is in Shmot Perek Yud Bet, Pesach in Egypt. That's where we actually went through the experience. In the second year in Bamidbar Perek Tet, they fulfilled the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. It says so in the context of the fact that there were those who were tamei and could not bring the Pesach and therefore had to come to Moshe with the request, what do we do? And Moshe returns to them with the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni. So that's in Bamidbar. And then you have the story of Yeshua and Gilgal, Perek Hay, which is the mitzvah of Brit Milah, again on Brit Milah on a national scale and Pesach on a national scale. The other three are really interesting moments. One is in the story of Chizkiyahu. The other is in the story of Yoshiyahu, and the third is in the story of Ezra. And I've given you reference to both these stories. Chizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu appear both in Divrei Hayamim and in Sefer Melachim, right? They appear both in Chronicles and in Kings. I've referenced them here in Divrei Hayamim, not particularly for any preference. I just find sometimes Divrei Hayamim easier to read in terms of the flow of the text, but either way, you could find the story. And then, of course, when they return under Ezra, we also have the reference to them fulfilling the mitzvah of Pesach. I want to do a quick glance at these last three, because there's some interesting references there that are relevant to us. Actually, I'll just show you this, and I'll pose it as a question, and then as we look through it, you'll see the answer. In Divrei Hayamim Bet Perek Lamed Hey, which is the Pesach of Yoshiyahu, okay, I skipped Chizkiyahu for now, just in Pesach Yoshiyahu, it says, V'lo na'aseh Pesach kamo b'Yisrael b'yimei Shmuel ha'Navi. Such a Pesach had not been done, not been kept since the days of Shmuel the prophet. V'lo asu k'Pesach asher asa Yoshiyahu v'Kohanim v'Leviyim v'Chol Yehuda v'Yisrael nimtza v'Yoshvei Yerushalayim. Such a Pesach like Yoshiyahu had done had not been done in all those years. In the same context, we find the same reference in Sefer Melachim, Perek Chav Gimel, which again is the same story, Pesach Yoshiyahu. Ki lo na'asa k'Pesach hazeh mimei ha'shoftim asher shaftu et Yisrael v'chol yemei malchei Yisrael v'chol malchei Yehuda. Such a Pesach that Yoshiyahu brought had not been done since all the days of the Shoftim. Just another reference to Mimei Shmuel. In Devarim it says Mimei Shmuel. In Malachim it says from the days of the Shoftim, but essentially it's the same context because Shmuel is the last story of the book of, or the last moment in the period or the era of the Shoftim before we start the era of the kings. And both of these references are striking because what does that mean? When they didn't keep Pesach all those years? Of course they kept Pesach. Like, how does it say that they didn't have a Pesach like this since the days of Shmuel? We don't even have a reference to Shmuel and the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. Never, nowhere does it say that Shmuel fulfilled the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. I would take it as a given that he did. But why suddenly is that the Pesach standard by which Yeshayahu is being compared? So this whole reference is a mystery, and we need to understand it. So I'm going to start with Pesach Chizkiyahu. And as we read through these three cases, Chizkiyahu, Yeshayahu, and Ezra, I think there's a pattern that will emerge that is helpful to us in the on the basis of what we have already established. So let's jump to Divrei Hayamim Bet, Perek Lamed, chapter 30. Actually, we need to go back to Perek. A little bit of review just of the story. Chizkiyahu comes to the throne, and he's a great king, and he has, Yaseh Yashar Ben Hashem, he does. Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, they're sort of the latter part. Chizkiyahu is a couple of generations before Yoshiyahu. They're the latter years, the latter century, if you will, of the kingdom of Israel. And there it says that Yoshiyahu Chizkiyahu was a great king. Hu b'shana harishona lemalcho b'chodesh harishon patachat daltot bet Hashem v'chazkem. In the very first year of his reign, he opened up the doors of the temple and he strengthened the temple, repaired them. And he brought the Kohanim and the Levim, and he gathered them together, and he said, we have to sanctify the temple. We have to revive it. This is post the days, the era of Achaz, which had brought idolatry into the kingdom and into Yerushalayim. And therefore, they had closed the temple. They've closed the doors of the sanctuary, and they've extinguished the lights, they didn't bring the Ktoret, and for all of these years, and it was a terrible stain on the record of Israel. And therefore, Chizkiyahu leads the people in a extraordinary north-to-south massive campaign of spiritual revival and renewal of the relationship between the people and God. Ata im levavi, he says in Pasuk Yud, ata im levavi lichvot brit l'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. It is in my heart to convene, to make a covenant with God. V'yashav mimeno chavana po, so that his anger should turn away, should turn back. And he talks earlier about the number of calamities that have befallen them. Don't be negligent in this. Al tishalu. Bachem b'char Hashem, God has chosen you. And so they all come together, the Levim and the Kohanim, and they gather all their brothers together, they come together in a national, massive campaign to sanctify, to purify the temple itself. And they go into the temple, they take out all of the tumah that had been brought into the temple, meaning all of the idolatry that had been introduced into the physical temple by Achaz and others. And they go and they burn it. They began on the first of the first month, which is the first of Nisan. And on the eighth day, they managed to come into the temple and begin their process. Uvayom shishasa lechodesh harishon kilu, and they finished on the 16th of the month. Now you understand, if they finished on the 16th of the month, they have a problem, which is they don't even get to rebuild the Mizbeach, right, until the 16th of the month of Nisan. When was Pesach? A few days earlier, right? 14th of Nisan. So they have a problem. And Vayamuti Hainu et Kobet Hashem et Mizbach HaOlav et Kol Kelav, etc. They revived all the temple utensils, and we sanctified them. They brought various offerings to renew and to reinaugurate the temple. And I just want to. They're singing, the Levim are singing, Ben Mitzotayim, Ben Nevalim, and the Kohanim are standing there, and everybody is celebrating this renewal of the temple itself. All right, let's move to Perek Lamed. Vayishlach Yechizkiyahu el kol Yisrael v'Yehuda v'gam igrot katav al Ephraim u'Menashe lavo l'Beit Hashem l'Yushalayim lasot Pesach l'Hashem l'Kei Yisrael. Then he sent messengers to all of Israel and all of Judah, in the north as well, because Ephraim and Manasseh as well. The northern kingdom has fallen, but nonetheless, there is a conversation to have. And they should all come to Yerushalayim, and they should all come to celebrate Pesach. So two things are odd here. Number one, they've rededicated the temple. Why Pesach? Like, why do they have to come to celebrate Pesach? Come to celebrate the next Chag. We're already past the 14th of Nisan. We're somewhere in the middle of the end of Nisan. So suddenly Chizkiyahu sends a message and he says to everybody, hey guys, let's come and do Pesach. When? In the 15th, in the 20th of the month? In the 25th of the month? Well, Pesach is on the 14th. Pesach is a Chag. You can't just do Pesach whenever you want. Vayivayetz ha-melech v'sarev v'chol ha-kahal b'Yushalayim lasot ha-pesach b'chodesh ha-sheni. So Chizkiyahu comes up with a brilliant idea. But wait a second. We can simply make Pesach in the second month. Now, when he means make Pesach in the second month, he doesn't mean Pesach sheni. He means, the way understood by the Gemara, is that they declared the year a leap year and therefore retroactively turned the clock back and made Nisan Adar Sheni, so that Pesach could be the next month. That was their way around the fact that they couldn't get to the Korban Pesach on Pesach because they missed the date. Ki lo yechlu lasot ba'et ahi, they couldn't do Pesach that time, and the regular time, ki hakohanim lo yitkatshu l'madai, because they hadn't yet finished the preparations of the temple. The king liked the idea. Most of them, they had not kept it in great numbers and according to the way it's written. And so they said, come and do the Pesach. And the Ratzim, the couriers went, and without going into too much detail, the people in Ephraim and Menashe, They didn't like the idea. They partially because they didn't like the notion that Chizkiyahu was asserting his authority over them, and partially because they didn't like this idea of a leap year. But in all cases, the people of Yerushalayim came and the Yasvu Yerushalayim Amrav Lasot Et Chag Matzot B'Chodesh Hashini Kahal Larov Meod. So they celebrated all Pesach and Chag HaMatzot, Vayishchatu HaPesach, Be'Abasa L'Chodesh HaShini, they slaughtered the Pesach on the 14th of the month, and Kohanim, Balevim, and all the people together, and they stood there, Ve'yamdu Amdam, Kimishpatam, Keturat Moshe, Ish HaLakim. And they fulfilled the mitzvah in accordance with the Torah as given to them. Ki Marbim Ha'am Rabat Me'Ephraim U'Menashe Yisachar Zvulun Lo Yitaharu. Not everybody came. Many did, but not everybody came. But they came and did it anyway. They didn't. They weren't. They were tamei. They weren't tahor. They couldn't. They didn't all do it in a state of purity. And he said, you know what? Chizkiyahu said to them, you know what? I don't give you tamei. Come and do it anyway, because God will forgive you. The most important thing is to do the Pesach. Kol levavoichin didrash elokim Hashem elokei avatav belok etaharat hakodesh. Everyone, their heart should come to God, should turn to God, even if they're not pure. And that's the story of Pesach Chizkiyah.
Could it be Tuma Hutra B'tzibur?
Yeah, maybe. It's not clear because most of the people were Tuma. It was just some Tuma. It gets very technical, but my issue isn't the Tuma and Tara. My issue is, look at the extent he goes to make sure that when this revival is done, it's capped with the celebration of Pesach. They didn't go and keep, do the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah that year, suddenly a couple of months late, 6 months late. The temple was closed last Rosh Hashanah. The temple hadn't been open till now. Something about the Pesach required them to say, we can't complete the process of this spiritual revival unless it includes a Korban Pesach. If we're a month late, we'll simply turn the clock back and make a leap year.
But when did he make this announcement? Didn't people celebrate Pesach in the original
Yisrael? That's the point. There was no temple. People celebrate Pesach when?
What was originally thought to be Nisan. They couldn't celebrate. They didn't celebrate.
No, because the temple had been closed. There was no Korban Pesach. There was no Mizbeach. Achaz closed the temple. There was no Mizbeach to function.
But there wasn't Vayochlu Matzot. They didn't celebrate. They don't celebrate Pesach without the temple?
Yeah. No. Evidently not. Or at least they did, but it didn't have the same status. And that's part of the question that we're going to explore. So what is it about this Pesach that they're talking about? Did they not fulfill Chag HaMatzot and Chag HaPesach? And we're really talking about Chag HaPesach or the Korban Pesach. Less so about Chag HaMatzot. Not our subject for today, but I'll open up a parenthesis. You're welcome to go and explore it. And if you want, I can send you some interesting articles. Pesach and Chag HaMatzot are separate. Pesach is on the 14th of the month. Chag HaMatzot starts on the 15th of the month. It is conceivable to have Chag HaMatzot without the Korban Pesach. We do it every year. It is conceivable, but that's a longer conversation, which I'm not going to digress to today, just because I want to make sure we finish this piece. So that's Chizkiyahu. Let's fast forward to Yoshiyahu. Chizkiyahu, and then you have a generation or two. You have Menashe in between, and Menashe is an idolatrous king, and he closes the temple, and he brings Baal and Ashtoreth into the temple, and then you have Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu, this is Menashe. Ben Shmanas Shmona Shanim Yoshiyahu B'mocho. Yoshiyahu comes to the throne as a young boy. He has a very important mentor in the persona of Tzfanya HaNavi, and the influence is clear, and he decides to change direction for the kingdom of Israel. We're now, the end of Yoshiyahu's death is 21 years before the Churban. Yoshiyahu is the last hope Israel has for turning the clock, or turning the tide back from the idolatry that had stooped into every corner of the country. Ben Shmona Shanim Yoshiyahu B'Molcho, U'Shloshim V'Echad Shana Malach B'Yishalayim, Yasa Shar B'nei Hashem, V'Yelech B'Darchei David Aviv, L'Osayah Min Esmol, he did what was right in the eyes of God. In the 8th year of his reign, U'Adenu Na'ar, he's still young, He began to seek God. And in the 12th year, he began to really begin a process of purifying the temple itself. Remember, he comes to the throne at the age of 8, so 12th year, and he's now 20, and he really starts a national, massive campaign to purify the temple. And he breaks down the altars of Baal and all the various idolatries that were in the temple, similar to what Chizkiyahu had done, but Yoshiyahu's was much more extensive. And he went into, because at this point there is no northern kingdom, so his reign includes what's left of the northern kingdom in the cities of Menashe and Ephraim and Shimon and Naphtali. and he breaks down the altars of idolatry, and in the 18th year of his reign, he begins a process to purify the temple. And if you remember the story about the finding of the Sefer Torah, we read it as a Haftorah every year, right? That happens here because of the efforts to purify the temple. Menashe had shut the doors of the temple for close to 50 years. And when they finally reopened in the days of Yoshio, amongst the things that they found was a portion of the Sefer Torah, probably subsections of pieces of the Torah that were originally used for the mitzvah Hakel, for the public reading of the king. But it includes, of course, the story of the Tochacha. They go to Chulda Neviyah, they ask for explanation, what it means, and Chulda says if they don't do something drastic, they're going to be destroyed. And so the process goes even more into high gear. V'yamod ha-melech al omdo. But that, actually, let me just go back a pasuk. This is Lamed Dalet Lamed. V'yal ha-melech beit Hashem. The king comes into the temple. All the people, the Kohanim, Levim, the from young to old, vaykrabo osnehem et kol divrei sefer habrit hanimza beit Hashem. He publicly reads this sefer habrit, which the book of the covenant, which was found in the temple, which is why I suggest. Suggestion I heard from Yoav Ben Nun, that the book itself was what was normally used to read in the midst of Hakel. Wasn't the king didn't read from a full Sefer Torah, he read from a scroll that had the portions of the midst of Hakel, which included the Tochacha, included the Shema, included the Seres HaDibros, and included various portions from Sefer Dvar. V'yamod ha-melech al-omdo, v'yichrot et habrit lifnei Hashem. So here we really have to stop and ask ourselves, both Chizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu talk about reenacting the covenant with God. Now, we all know that the covenant with God is unbreachable. It's eternal. And yet, they talk about making this covenant the way we stood at Har Sinai and made a covenant with God. L'lechet acharei Hashem lishmot mitzvotav etvotav v'chukav. To observe, to walk in God's ways and to observe on all the mitzvot of the Torah. V'chol levavo v'chol nafsho. La'asot et divrei habrit ha'ktuvim al ha'sefer hazeh. And to full commit themselves to the words of the brit. And the only explanation really, and I think it's the pshat of it, is that there is a commitment to fulfill the mitzvah, but then on a national scale, when Israel has veered from that path, stooped to idolatry, embraced idolatry, rejected God on such a dramatic level, once that process of tshuva is underway on a national scale, it requires a, not a new brit, but a renewal of that brit. It requires them to consciously say, we violated, we veered, we're coming back, and we're renewing that brit. That's required. That's part of the experience. Whether it's required or not, I don't know, but it's certainly part of the drama of that experience. V'yamed et kol ha'nimtza b'Yerushalayim u'binyamin v'yasu yishvei Yerushalayim kibrit elokim elokei avoteh. And they make this brit with all the people. V'yasu Yoshiyahu et kol ha'tovot mikol ha'aretzot ha'shel bnei Yisrael v'yaved et kol ha'nimtza b'Yisrael v'lavod et Hashem elokeihem. They remove all the idolatry from the entire land, all of his days. Everything's great. So a whole discussion as to whether, how thorough it was, but certainly, for now, we'll take it on face value. Next chapter. V'yas Yoshiyahu b'Yerushalayim Pesach l'Hashem. Again, finish the brit and does Pesach. Vayishchatu a Pesach miyabasa lechodesh Rishon. But unlike his great grandfather, he decides not to do it in Chodesh Nisan, in Chodesh an year. He doesn't have to worry about the leap year. He, in fact, does it on the proper month of the 14th of Nisan. Etc. And the whole discussion of the involvement. V'shachatu ha-Pesach, they slaughter the Korban Pesach itself. V'itkaddushu v'chinu l'achechem, sanctify yourselves, prepare yourselves. Yoshiyahu brings all the offerings. And then, Vayishchatu HaPesach. They cook they prepare the Korban Pesach in fire, roasted, kamishpat, in accordance with its laws. This Leviim are singing, the Kohanim are doing, everybody's celebrating. Ve'yasu b'nei Yisrael nimtzim et haPesach be'et ahi. They fulfill the mitzvah of Pesach. Ve'et Chag HaMatzot shivat yamim, as well as this holiday of Chag HaMatzot. And then we come to the verse. V'lo nisa k'Pesach kamo b'Yisrael yimei Shmuel Anavi. Thus, this Pesach, or this kind of Pesach, there was no Pesach like this since the days of Shmuel. Fascinating. No Pesach like this since the days of Shmuel. And we have no record of Shmuel fulfilling the mitzvah of Pesach. No Pesach like this since the days of Shmuel. And this was all in the 18th year of his reign. Nasa Pesach Hazem. Story goes on to that there, but for now our issue is we're going to stop for a moment. One last story, which is Ezra Perek Vav. Jews come back in the days of to the land of Israel. Sefer Ezra is a very confusing timeline. After the Babylonian exile, the Jews come back. They come back in stages. We are used to thinking about two stages of the return from Zion. There are actually three. The book opens with the period of Zerubbabel and Yeshua ben Yehozadak HaKohen HaGadol, the early years of the return, which coincide with the 70-year prophecy and the rebuilding of the temple, and then things all go south. What happened is unclear, but after chapter 4, everything goes south, and then eventually Ezra comes. Ezra comes later. Ezra comes in a later stage, whether it's a few years later or whether it's a significant amount of time later is debatable, but Ezra comes at a later stage. And Ezra has to lead the people in this kind of spiritual revolution again. They're all married to Gentile wives, and they're all worshipping the deities of the land, and Ezra has to not just revive the temple, but also engage the people in a process of tshuva. And there we find the following verse. Ikrivu lechanukat bet elah, the people brought, they rededicated the temple, they cleansed, and again, the same purification process and the same rebuilding of the temple. And they brought all kinds of offerings. And they set their priests and their divisions, and they set the Levium into their roles. Everything was right, rebuilt the temple into what it should be. And on the 14th of the month, they brought a Pesach. Why? Because the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. That doesn't mean just from Tumah, but also from everything else going on. And they were able to bring the Pesach for all of those who had returned from the exile. They ate, the people of Israel who participated in the Pesach, those who were prepared to separate themselves from the idolatry and the Gentile wives that they had and the idolatrous cultures that they had and to seek God, they could partake in the Pesach v'yasu Chag HaMatzot shivat yamim v'simcha, and then they could celebrate Chag HaMatzot 7 days with joy. Ki simcha Hashem, for God had enabled them to be joyous. V'sev lev melech Ashur aleihem l'chazek yadem b'melechat beit elokim elokei Yisrael, and had turned the heart of the king of Ashur, king of Babel, to them in order to enable them to build their temple. So what's fascinating about all three of these instances, so the only references we come back to the source page, the only references we have to keeping to references to fulfilling the mitzvah of Pesach after our chapter are three episodes that are all tied by one common theme, namely the revival of Jewish life, the restoration, the tshuva, national tshuva movement, the notion that they had abandoned that covenant, that they had engaged in idolatry, and the way back was get rid of the idolatry and to do tshuva and to commit themselves, etc., and to bring a Korban Pesach. It's almost as if, and that's essentially where we are, where we're going with this, that the Pesach has two roles. Its normal role on a daily, every year basis is to fulfill the mitzvah of reenacting the experience of Yetziat Mitzrayim. That's what Pesach was. And every year, more or less, the rest of the for Jewish history. But every once in a while, there's a moment in which, unfortunately, because of a national stooping to or trend towards idolatry and the need to correct the path and bring the people back, there's a renewal of the Brit by Chizkiyahu. There's a renewal of the Brit by Yoshiyahu, the Brit with God. That's not just, we're not talking about Bris Mila, we're talking about the entire contract relationship with God from Har Sinai and the days of Ezra. In all three of these instances, it is accompanied by the reference to the bringing of a Pesach. And that's essentially what the Radak here is saying. I couldn't find a translation of this, so I'll translate it. When it says that such a Pesach had not been done, and again, it doesn't mean that they didn't fulfill the mitzvah of Pesach and Chag HaMatzot every year. They had to have. But it means that this Pesach was different. Shayu ko Yisrael b'lev echad l'avodat Hashem. It means that it was a Pesach accompanied by the process similar to what we went through in Mitzrayim. To pull back from the idolatry of Egypt, the Pesach becomes the symbol of that contract, that brit, that entering into the brit with God and going away from the idolatry of Egypt. That's what it was in Mitzrayim. And therefore, that's what it served as at key moments in our history. Not just the mitzvah every year of reenacting Yetziat Mitzrayim, right? Ke'ilu Yetzanu Mitzrayim, but in fact, to do what we did in Mitzrayim, which was to abandon the idolatry that had overwhelmed our people and return to God. That's what we did in Egypt, and that's what we did at moments, key moments. One key moment, says the Radak, that does not say they brought a Pesach, but one key moment is Shmuel. Because Kein Amar b'Shmuel, that's exactly what it says in Shmuel. It says in Shmuel Aleph Perek Zion, I believe, either Vav or Zion, Vayinahu kol beit Yisrael achrei Hashem. Shmuel enabled, Shmuel brought the people of Israel back to God after the idolatry that had become part of the culture in the land of Israel through all the days of the Shoftim. Ve'amar, and he said to them, Ve'yasiru b'nei Yisrael at ba'alim, they removed all the ba'alim and the ashtarot, all the idolatries, Ve'yavdu at Hashem levado, and they served God alone, exclusive, without other idols. That's a quote from the Sefer Shmuel. So when the text says that they brought a Pesach, and they hadn't brought such a Pesach since the days of Shmuel, what it's referring to is, although the reference to Shmuel having brought a Pesach, it's referring to the spiritual revival, it's referring to the renewal of the Brit. And therefore, Gan Pesach Shesach Chizkiyahu wasn't quite complete enough. This verse is in by Yoshiyahu, because even the Pesach that Chizkiyahu did, it was half-baked. There were many that didn't want to do it because it was in the wrong month, and they made fun of the messengers, and they taunted him because it was in the wrong month, and they were tamei. Whereas Yoshiyahu, three generations later, was much more in the right month, and it was a much bigger process of tshuva, and it had all of the trappings and all the flavor of what it had in the days of Shmuel. Days of Shmuel? You know what? Let's take a quick glance at Shmuel. Herring Zion. Was that the first time? That's very fine. Sorry. Pasuk Zayin, God, this is Shmuel's message. That this is Shmuel at the beginning of his career. Shmuel Hanavi. Shmuel had grown up in the Mishkan, which had just been destroyed. The Mishkan fell in chapter 5 of Sefer Shmuel when the Plishtim captured the Ark. But Yomer, and it just returned to them. The ark just came back. But Yomer Shmuel kol beit Yisrael lemoi, in b'chol levavchem atem shavim al Hashem. If you are really doing tshuva with a whole heart, hasidu et alei necham mitochachem v'ashtarot, remove the idolatry from your midst. Hachinu levavchem al Hashem, prepare your hearts to God. Ivdu levado, serve God alone, not as one of the pantheon of gods. V'yatzel etchem yad plishtim, and he'll save you from the plishtim. But you have to be sincere. And they do. They remove the Baalim and Ashtoret and the idols of Canaan. They served God alone. And then, and he brings them all back to him. He brings them to a Brit with them in Mitzpeh. And that's the just, they go to war against the Plishim. They're victorious. All right, the rest of it I'm gonna skip, but get that's essentially what the Radak is saying, is that sets a paradigm for a national tshuva process. And so when it is reenacted by Chizkiyahu and by Yoshiyahu, it's accompanied by a Pesach, because the Pesach was more than a mitzvah. Pesach was the symbol of the Brit. It served as that symbol in Egypt for various reasons. It had to do with Egyptian culture, but it was an act of defiance against Egypt. When we ate the Korban Pesach in Egypt, we did it as a defiance against Egypt. Some have suggested that's why it had to be roasted and it had to be whole, so that it could be seen by the Egyptians that we were fulfilling the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. Whether or not the Egyptians worshipped the cat, the lamb, as some suggest, or I think it's more likely, is simply that they were exerting themselves, they were asserting their independence. They were saying to Egypt, "You can't stop us. We're leaving tomorrow. We're serving our God tonight. We're bringing a korban. We're putting blood on the doorposts." Although Rashi says it was on the inside of the doorposts, the Rambam and others say it was on the outside of the doorposts, as if to say, we are celebrating our freedom right now, and you can't do a darn thing to stop us. It's an act of defiance. They needed that act of defiance to walk into, to enter into the breach with God. All of that is the Korban Pesach. Now, that's only half the picture, because what we haven't addressed is the question of Bris Milah. So where does Bris Milah fit into this picture? So we know that Bris Milah is a prerequisite to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, but why? What is it about Milah that makes it the prerequisite mitzvah to this Brit of Pesach? And there are several pieces to the story, but here, again, I'm walking into a little bit of the world of conjecture. I think it's important. There is a whole field of study called in the world of Tamei Mitzvot, the world of trying to understand Mitzvot. There are basically three approaches. One approach says we can't rationalize Mitzvot; they're all decrees of the king, and we don't necessarily understand them, and therefore we just fulfill them. Again, that is one school of thought. There's a second school of thought that sees sort of the the notion Mistako Baraisa Rubara Alma, that God looked into the world of the world, looked into the Torah, and from it created the world. That the Torah is a blueprint for the world, and there's some metaphysical, spiritual connection between every mitzvah and every part of the world we live in, at a fundamental level. The second school of thought in rationalizing or understanding mitzvot. There's a third school. And the third school, which is championed by the Rambam, is based on an expression that appears in the Gemara in a number of places. I'm going to actually stop sharing because I need to explain some background. That's based on a phrase that appears in the Talmud in a number of places. Dibrat Torah ki lashon b'nei adam. The Torah speaks in the language of man. Some understand that phrase simply to mean that the language that it uses, that the phrases, that the terminology is contemporary to the time that the Torah was given. But the Rambam and others suggest that it actually goes much deeper than that, and that many of the mitzvot in the Torah were designed to be responses to phenomenon that existed at that time. Now, the reason it's a little dangerous is because it always raises the question, okay, well, what happens if the phenomena no longer exists. Right? Famously, the Rambam uses this to explain korbanot, that sacrifices were a kind of acquiescence to or a concession to the world of idolatry that existed at that time. And that the purer form of service is prayer because you don't need the sacrifice. It raises the obvious question, okay, so what happens if that cultural phenomenon changes, does the mitzvah still stand? So the Rambam is very clear. The Rambam, who championed this approach to understanding mitzvot, was very clear that the mitzvah is eternal, even if its original context may have been circumstantial. He uses this to explain meat and milk together, that's how the idolaters, that was an idolatrous practice, etc. One of the explanations in this regard is the mitzvah of Brit Milah. So, for example, The in a number of places where the Torah addresses, I'll start to something simple. Let's take the mitzvah, for example, before we get to Brit Milah, mitzvah of Ritzuat Eved, the notion of a slave, Eved Ivri, who says at the end of 6 years he doesn't want to go free. He's an indentured servant. He doesn't want to go free after the 6 years that he's required. He wants to stay as a servant of his master. So what do we do? There's a mitzvah in the Torah. It appears in a few places. They have to take him to a doorpost and they pierce his ear with against the doorpost. So again, Rashi says it's because of the ear that heard in Har Sinai that we are God's servants and not man's servants. This person wants to stay as an Eved. He needs to be corrected, if you will. But there are others who suggest that, no, if you have to go back into the culture of the time and realize that part of what it meant to have a servant, or to use a more intense term, to have a slave, was to brand them. And you branded them in the ancient world by maiming them. That was their brand, because they couldn't rebel. In the laws of Hammurabi, for example, it says that if a slave runs away and is recaptured, you brand them by taking off a finger or an arm, right, or a limb. Why? Because that brands them so they can't rebel again and shows to everybody, this one is my slave. So the Torah, some suggest that the Torah is essentially responding to that and saying if he really wants to remain a servant to his master, you can't brand them. That's brutal. That's cruel. That's inhumane. That's not right. So something much more subtle, which is piercing their ear, is a much more subtle and small and significant and culturally acceptable way of achieving that goal of saying he's branded. What do the ancients do? I'll show you an example. What do the ancients do? Here's a story in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Aleph, just to get a sense of it. This is Nachash HaAmoni. Nachash, Ammonite, Canaanite king, comes and he lays siege to the city of Yavesh Gilad. The circumstances here are not my issue. So the people of Yavesh Gilad, Israelites living on the other side of the Jordan River, in an open area called Yavesh Gilad, said to the king of Ammon, named Nachash, state your terms, we surrender. What are your terms? Make a brit with us and we'll serve you. We can't defend ourselves. So Nachash stated his terms. Nachash, bizot echrot lachem. This is the brit with you. This is my condition for surrender. Binkor lachem kol ayin yamin. Everybody gouges out their right eye and sends it to me. That's the brand. I'll make it a shame over all of Israel. The rest of the story is not relevant. They obviously don't do it. Shmuel comes to the raid. Shaul comes to the raid and they fight and they conquer and not doesn't happen. But the notion that the Canaanites symbolized slavery and servitude by branding their slaves, that's significant. I'll give you another example of an ancient practice. In Sefer Breshit, how are the servants of Paro referred to? Potiphar is called. What is Potiphar referred to as? A servant of Paro. Sris Paro. Look at all the translations of Sris Paro. They say something very euphemistic. Servant of Paro, officer of Paro, scout, whatever. Sris means somebody who is?
Castrated.
To be in the service of the ancient kings, you had to be castrated. Achashverosh has two harems. One under the charge of Haggai and the other under the charge of Shashgaz. Both are called Srisei HaMelech because Achashverosh isn't going to let his servants anywhere near his harems if they're not castrated. It's every servant, Potiphar, Haggai, the Sar HaMashkim and Sar HaTabachim are referred to as Sarisei Paro. Right? To be a servant of the king, you needed to be not a threat to the king's harem. And so part of that sign, that part of that brand of servitude was, in the case of the kings, a little more dramatic. It was castration. When we entered into the service of God, we became Avdei HaMelech. We became servants of the king. But God is not going to brand us. Certainly not good. There are cultures, by the way, in which when you entered into a high-level service of God, you commit yourselves to not having children. Right? That's the principle of celibacy in the Catholic Church. The Torah says, on the contrary, we're going to sanctify and elevate the family in the Jewish world. But what do we say in the benching every day? What is Brit Milah? What's the phrase we use? Britcha chatamta bivsareinu. Your brit with us, you sealed in our flesh. Mila is a sign of the brit with God, not in the form of the castration, God forbid, and not in the form of the maiming of a taking of a limb, God forbid, like the of Nachash Ammoni. Much more subtle, much more humane, much more acceptable, but it remains a sign, a physical brand of the Brit with God.
Is there a connection to Brit Ben Abtarim where you also have to cut them in half?
The animals?
Yeah.
So I will, I wasn't going to go there today. Really, there is, but it's actually closer to Korban Pesach than it is to Brit Milah. It's a form of Korban. It's a form of korban, but it was actually very common practice to enact a brit by taking animals and dividing them in half or walking between. Much more, it was sort of analogous to the phrase "till death do us part." If you see the connection, it's referred to in Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu describes it in detail, that kind of brit that God made with Abraham. God made two covenants with Abraham: brit ben Abtarim, and I'm going to go to Brit Milah in a moment, and they are both connected, but they're the same way Mila and Pesach are connected. Anyways, if Mila is the sign of the covenant, and so is Pesach, a symbol of that covenant, the difference between them is that Mila was that Pesach was a national mitzvah. As a people, as a whole, as a nation, we entered into a covenant with God, like at Har Sinai. Brit Milah is a personal mitzvah. Every individual, at least the males, right, but it creates a status on the society. It's a society that carries the Brit of Brit Milah and the sign of that covenant on their flesh as an individual. So the individual Brit is Brit Milah. The national Brit is Korban Pesach. The two of them are connected. There's a connection parallel to Brit Ben Abtarim, but for now we'll just leave it at Mila and Pesach, because that's where Sefer Yeshua has taken us, to the connection between the prerequisite of the personal Brit and commitment, Brit Milah, the sign, the Britcha Chatamta Bifsarenu, and the national at Brit, as demonstrated in the Korban Pesach. Interesting observation about Brit as a sign of loyalty to the master, loyalty to the king. Not in the form of the Swiss, but in a much more delicate and acceptable form of the Brit. One of the interesting phenomena we find in Tanakh is that every time a king, every time a leader takes on a servant or devoted servant or assistant, we've seen this already, we saw it in the case of Yeshua, they rename them. Remember, we had this discussion about Yeshua. When did Yeshua take on the extra yud of his name from Hoshea to Yeshua? When he became Misharet Moshe, when he became Moshe's servant. Much like the kings of Babylonian kings, the Egyptian kings, when they took the kings of Israel and turned them into vassal states, vassal kings, puppet kings, they renamed them. Paro renames Eliakim to Yehoiakim. Nebuchadnezzar, when he places Matanyah on the throne, Vayasef Shmo Tzidkiyahu, he changes his name to Tzidkiyahu. Moshe calls Hoshea Yehoshua. Part of that branding is not just the Brit, but part of the branding is the name. You carry the name that the master gives you, that's a sign of loyalty to the king. What do we do at a circumcision?
We give the name.
We give the child his Hebrew name. We do it at the bris. Because the very first bris ever fulfilled, which was by Abraham, included a name change. Avram went to Avraham at the Brit Milah, because it was the same phenomenon. You take on a physical identification of the Brit with the master, with the king, you take on a name that identifies you with the king. The two are interconnected. It comes to the whole question of the names of Israel in Egypt, but I'll leave that for a different year. Where does all of this, let's go back to the mitzvah. There's a third leg to this table, and that's where I want to conclude it today. Let's go back to the mitzvah of Brit Milah itself in the Torah. Bereishit Perek Yud Zayin. So Bereishit Perek Yud Zayin, God comes to Avram at the age of 99. He doesn't yet have a child, and so that's part of the requirement, that he have Brit before he can have a child. Betna Briti Beni Benecha, I will give you my Brit between you, me, and you, ve'arbe otcha v'mod mod, and then you will become exceedingly many. There is a requirement, Brit Milah, if you look at it in the scheme, in the context of the Torah, Brit Milah was required before Abraham and Sarah could have children. Abraham falls on his face, and he says, and God says to him as follows, here is my Brit with you, ve'yita la'avah mongayim, and through it you will become a multitude of nations. Again, in contrast to the Swiss Paro, where if you have that as your Brit, there's no continuation of the nation. The whole context is exact opposite. But first, v'lo yikare ot shimcha Avram. Your name will no longer be Avram. V'yashimcha Avraham. You have to change your name to Avraham. Ki Avram on goyim netaticha, make you father of many nations. V'ifreiti otcha, I will multiply you b'mod ma'od. V'akimoti ad v'riti b'ni u'v'necha. U'v'en zarecha acharecha l'dovatam l'vrit olam. This is an eternal covenant between me and you for generations to come. L'yot l'cha l'Elohim u'l'zarecha acharecha. To be your God. This is, you accept me upon you and your children as your God by this mitzvah of brit milah. And here's the catch. V'natati lecha ulzarcha acharecha et eretz megurecha et kol eretz kna'an lachuzat olam. V'ayiti lahem nelokim. If you do this, I will give you the land of Israel as your inheritance. V'yomer elokim ul Avraham v'ata et briti tishmor. But you keep my brit. Ata v'zarcha acharecha. You and your seed after you. Zot briti asher tishmor. This is the brit that you will have to keep. Imol lechem kol zachar. You will circumcise every male. In the age of 8 days. Ben shmonat yamim imol lechem. But the contract is between the brit that we fulfill, which is the et britcha chatamta bifsareinu, the brit with God, which includes the name change, the identification that we are Bnei Yisrael, Bnei Yaakov, we are God's people, we are the Amskulav, we carry God's name, He is our King, Melech Malchayim Melachim, we keep that Brit, B'tchay Chatamta B'Vsareinu, God's response is, I will give you the land of Israel. By the way, in benching, the phrase, B'tchay Chatamta B'Vsareinu, appears in the second bracha. What's the second bracha about? The first bracha is about God who provides food. What's the second bracha about? The land of Israel. Ala aretz v'ala mazon. And it's into the bracha of the land that we include the mitzvah of the reference to Brit Milah, because that's exactly what God said. The prerequisite to be able to inherit this land and give it over generation after generation is Brit Milah on the one hand, and we become God's people at Yitziat Mitzrayim on the other. Brit Milah. Those are the two britot, individually and nationally, that enable us to leave Egypt and enter into the service of God and come to the land of Israel. Now, I'm going to conclude this year with a fascinating medrash. Fascinating medrash. It's going to take us into the world of drash, but I can't resist. Because this one is remarkable. We've spent the last two shiurim drawing from text in all through Tanakh, drawing together the link between the brit, the loyalty of God, to God, and not to idolatry, in the form of the mitzvah of Pesach, and in the form of the mitzvah of Brit Milah. Okay, I even showed you the Pirkei Drei Rabbi Eliezer last week that says that when they put the blood on the doorposts, they put the blood mingled, commingled blood, mixed blood, between the blood of the Korban Pesach and the blood of
the Brit Milah.
Brit Milah. Fascinating medrash. I stopped that medrash one paragraph before the end. I want to read you the continuation of that same medrash. Israel continued the mitzvah of circumcision until they had divided into two kingdoms. Because the assumption was that the kingdom of the north, which was idolatrous in general for most of its time, probably did not fulfill, could keep the mitzvah of Milah. Until, who was the Navi who stood at the heart of the campaign to bring the northern kingdom back from idolatry? Eliyahu. V'yamad Eliyahu zuchulato v'kinei kina gdola, and he was zealous of great zealousness, v'nishbal ha-shamayim shlo l'vital, and he took an oath that there won't be rain on the land, and he went to war with Ahab and against Izebel, and they sought to kill him, and Eliyahu had to run, v'yamit palal ha-kodesh baruch hu, and finally God said to him, run to Har Chorev. Amad Eliyahu, you all know the story of Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel, right? Right? He has this big showdown with the prophets of Baal, and against the idolatry of Baal, and he brings the and he kills the prophets of Baal, and Yizevel wants to kill him. Finally, Eliyahu barach me'eretz Yisrael v'nimlat, and 40 days, and he eats, and he runs, and he comes to Har Chorev. And he comes and he stands in the very same place that Moshe stood. God says to Malach HaPo Eliyahu, what are you doing here? And he says, now here we need the actual verse. So let me show you the actual verse. Because Medrash doesn't quote the whole thing, which is classic text Medrash, but we need the whole thing. Comes to Har Chorev, and he has this whole vision about Ruach and Esh, and he's in the cleft of the rock, and okay. God says to him, Ma lecha po Eliyahu, Eliyahu, what are you doing here? What's his response? Vayome kano ki neiti l'Hashem elokei tzva'ot, I was zealous for you, God. Ki yazvu britcha, because Israel abandoned your covenant. Forgive me, I'm going to go 2 minutes extra. Israel abandoned your brit. They destroyed your altar, B'nai Yisrael, et mizbechatecha rasu, and they killed your prophets, v'nevi'echa kubacharev, and I am the last left, v'terani levadi. Eliyahu, the zealous Navi for God, accuses Israel of abandoning the Brit. Which Brit is he talking about? What did Israel do to abandon the Brit? They embraced idolatry. Says the Medrash. Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu. Eliyahu, le'olam ata mekaneh? Are you going to be zealous for me forever? Kineta bashitim agilui arayot. The Medrash identifies Pinchas with Eliyahu and says, go, you were zealous back of the story of Shittim when you were zealous in the story of Pinchas. You're still zealous for me. You know what? I'm going to teach you a lesson, says the Medrash. Chayecha. She'en Yisrael osin brit milah ad she'ata ru'eh be'enecha. Israel is going to, you are going to have to fulfill the mandate. Eliyahu was referred to by the Navi as Malach HaBrit. He's going to come to every circumcision. Why do we have a chair for Eliyahu at every circumcision? Yeah. Why do we have a chair for Elijah at circumcisions? It's not because we want to give him a covet. It's because the Medrash says that for eternity, as tshuva, for accusing Israel of abandoning the Brit, Eliyahu has to come to every circumcision so that he can testify before God that Israel not only didn't abandon the covenant, they committed themselves to the covenant of Brit Milah. Beyond all reason and expectation. And therefore, mekan itkinu chachamim shiwasin moshav kavod lemalach habrit. That's why we have a kisei shel Eliyahu. And every brit. That's the Medrash. I'm going to go one step further. There are only two places in the entire ritual of Jewish life in which we invite Eliyahu in. Brit Milah. And Pesach.
Seder.
And basically, because Eliyahu's job is to testify that we did not abandon the Brit, but that we kept the Brit. And the Brit is symbolized by Brit Milah on the one hand and Brit of Pesach on the other. And through that, we merit to achieve what? To reclaim the land of Israel. And here I will conclude with something somebody pointed out last week, which is the quote-unquote irony of history, that the two most fulfilled mitzvot in the cultural frame of reference of our people, no matter how assimilated we get, are circumcision and Pesach. Not necessarily in the context of the Korban, but certainly in the context of the celebration of the holiday. And that comes back to Eliyahu's role at both to testify to the loyalty of Israel to these two britot. All right, we've overstepped by 5 minutes. We're going to stop here, but I wanted to pull those pieces together. Bezrat Hashem, next week, we start chapter 6. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. So
thank
beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
The rabbi, when was the leap year normally declared? Wasn't that in Tishrei?
Well, so the Beit Din had the power to declare the year a leap year up until the month of Adar.
Uh-huh.
It had that when the operation of the Beit Din was dynamic and you declared each year when the leap year was, they essentially would look at the season more or less pre-Pesach during the month of Adar, and they would kind of make a determination what was the status of the crops and what was the status of the ground. And on that basis, they would declare. But they could not. But the halacha is very clear. You can't make a leap year in the month of Nisan. You can. The last month they have as a chance to declare the year a leap year is the month of Adar. That's why if you know the Mishnayos in Megillah, there's an oddity in the Mishnayos in Megillah. The Mishnah says, if you read the Megillah in Adar Rishon, what do you do in Adar Sheni? And it's an odd Mishnah because the way we have a calendar, you'd never have a situation where you've read the Megillah in Adar Rishon, and now you come to Adar Sheni and you have to figure out whether you should need to read the Megillah again. But when you had a dynamic calendar and they declared the leap year dynamically, it is conceivable that they would get to the end of the month of Adar, they've already fulfilled the mitzvah of Purim, and then they make the year a leap year, and now suddenly there's an Adar Sheni. So it could happen that way. But the limit was always the month of Nisan. Once Nisan started, you couldn't do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.